May it please the Court, Your Honors, I am Murray Feldman, one of the counsel for the State of Alaska, and here this morning arguing on behalf of all the joint appellants in this case. The overarching question presented is whether the Fish and Wildlife Service's determination that the polar bear, a species that occupies the entirety of its historic range with population levels at an all-time high, whether that species is likely to be on the brink of extinction within 45 years, and whether that service determination is arbitrary or capricious, where the service did not explain how the bear would be threatened throughout its range, where the service's own population forecasting models showed substantial populations remaining in at least two ecoregions at mid-century, where the service relied on population models with invalid assumptions and that were not to be used for outward forecasting, where the service either did not apply its definition of the ambiguous term likely in the definition of a threatened species, or never properly defined that term in its rulemaking, where the service did not adequately take into account the effects of its listing on Canada's polar bear conservation program, and where the service did not adequately explain how the loss of some habitat in an extensive range would put the species on the brink of extinction by mid-century. On this record, Your Honors, the service did not provide the required support for its threatened determination, and the service did not follow the statutorily required procedures. Even if one accepts what the appellants have asserted and pointed out are the flaws in the service's population model projections, and those flaws under this court's APA review standards, and especially for the review of computer models used to support agency rulemaking, even if one accepts those outputs, the finding that the polar bear is threatened throughout its range is inconsistent with the service's own determination that significant numbers of bears will remain in the convergent ice and archipelago ecoregions at key century. So there are two key points here. The number of bears and the amount of habitat that the service found would still be remaining at mid-century, and the fact that the service's reliance on and its determination that these populations of bears may be affected at mid-century is not the same as and does not equal a determination that they would be on the brink of extinction. Instead, there needs to be a record-supported determination that the species in these areas would be an endangered species, which the service has said means on the brink of extinction at year 45, to support its present determination that the species is threatened in those areas. Without such documentation and findings, the service could list a species just on a determination of an effect without reaching the statutorily required threshold for a threatened species under the Endangered Species Act. So here in this instance, the service's own record data contradicts its brink of extinction conclusion for these ecoregions. And for this reason, the listing should be vacated for the service to address which, if any, portions of the range may be threatened for the bear, and then determine if those portions are significant under the service's current policies for doing so.
Brink of extinction, is that different than danger of extinction?
Your Honor, that is how, in the proceedings below with Judge Sullivan, that is how the service determined on the limited remand that it interpreted the phrase in danger of extinction in the statutory definition of endangered, which then is incorporated into the statutory definition of threatened, because a threatened species is one that is likely to become endangered in the foreseeable future.
And endangered is one which is in danger of extinction.
Correct. So it's on the brink of extinction then.
And that was in the, those are the lawyers for the government, or the was that the agency that said danger means brink?
It was the agency came back on limited remand with a memorandum that's in the record from the court below, and that we've cited to in our briefs, that provided that interpretation.
Okay, thanks.
Your Honors, on the population forecasting models, the service relied in part on its determination on two different models. One was what they called a carrying capacity model, and the other was a Bayesian network model. Now, under this court standards and the Administrative Procedure Act, the service is required to show a rational connection between these models and the reality that the models purport to represent. As we've noted in our briefs, it's principally the Columbia Falls Aluminum versus EPA case and the U.S. Air Tours Association versus FAA case from this circuit that provide those standards for an agency's use and application of models. And when challenged, the service is required to provide a full analytical defense and must examine key assumptions as part of the agency's affirmative burden to promulgate and explain a non-arbitrary and non-capricious rule. And the state of Alaska and other commenters identified the modeling concerns in their comments, but the service did not adequately respond either in its response to public comments in the final rule or in its response to the state of Alaska under Section 4I of the Act. If the service had responded, it could have changed the outcome here significantly, or it could have changed the approach that the service applied if it had responded to those comments. And what those comments identified, for instance, for the carrying capacity model, is that even the creators of the model in the record, in the United States Geological Survey report forwarding the model to the Fish and Wildlife Service, said that the carrying capacity model was premised on an assumption, which was that polar bear density would not change over time, so that any unit reduction in habitat would lead to, under the model, a corresponding one-to-one unit reduction in polar bear population size. The USGS identified that that assumption was almost certainly not valid.
On these two models, you press that a lot. They were pretty clear in saying they just used them after the fact to confirm earlier findings. They were not suggesting that they were dispositive in and of themselves. You press it over and over again, and it's beating up on something that seems to me not critical. That's not what they were principally resting on. So whatever the frailties are, they are, but they made their findings.
Your Honor, our position is that while the service may have identified that the models were additional evidence or confirmed their earlier findings in the proposed rule, because of the way the service made its final determination, its reliance on the modeling is so intertwined with the rest of it, it's not possible to separate what the contribution of those models was to its decision.
Well, I didn't struggle with that, I must say. It's a big case. I didn't find it difficult, and I thought their explanation on that was pretty clear. The other thing that's perplexing is over and over again, you keep citing to the USGS is somehow supportive of your position, and every time I read that in your briefs, I got confused and I had to go back. They were saying threatened was too low, that the agency should have found it was an endangered species. I what am I missing? Over and over again, you cite them, and their conclusion is that the service didn't go far enough.
Your Honor, we cite them for, you're correct, their statements about the population models and the data they provided.
You cite a critical source, I'm going to go read it, and that critical source goes just the opposite way that you would want us to go.
I understand your point, Your Honor, but ultimately that determination is the Fish and Wildlife Services, so they are the agency charged with implementing
the data. Well, then I would have expected your argument to us to be ignore the Geological Service. They don't know what they're talking about. Let's just focus on the service. That's not what you argued. You argued, let's start looking at several places. Let's look at the Geological Service, look what they say, and you take a piece of their language and forget to continue on, which says, and so they're concerned because they thought it should be endangered, not threatened.
I understand that was one of their concerns, Your Honor, but we were focusing more on the data and the numbers and the models that the USGS had provided and how the Fish and Wildlife Service then handled that data and addressed it in its rulemaking.
Okay.
Your Honor, on the statutory definition of likely, we'll point out the service failed to appropriately define or apply that term, and there's really two points here that in the rulemaking, the service had first identified that was going to apply the definition of likely from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, AR4 definition, but then it didn't carry through with that. And then on review here, it has said no, it didn't mean to apply that definition to the statutory term likely in the definition of a threatened species, but that it really meant it to mean probable or having a better chance of occurring than not, but it did not identify in the listing rule where it stated that interpretation, and it did not explain how it could have two different interpretations of the same term likely in the rule and how it would reconcile those. So in conclusion, Your Honors, based on the errors identified in our briefing and before this court, we ask that the listing determination be vacated and remanded to the Fish and Wildlife Service for further consideration. Thank you.
We'll hear from the Fish and Wildlife Service.
Yes, good morning. I'm Catherine Hazard here on behalf of the Fish and Wildlife Service. The service listed the polar bear as a threatened species based on the impact of projected sea ice declines on the species' ability to survive. Judge Garland, I wanted to respond to your inquiry about the brink of extinction. In Interior's supplemental filing in the district court, which is in the joint appendix at 121 to 132, the Department of Interior explained its interpretation of an endangered species and distinguishes that from a threatened species, indicating it has a lot to do with a temporal aspect, how imminent is the likelihood of extinction. And in addition, in that supplemental filing is a description of the legislative history addressing when Congress added the threatened status in the Endangered Species Act, which has considerable discussion of the term likely and Congress's recognition that a high degree of deference is going to be owed to the agency because you can't necessarily assign a specific number to the likelihood of a species becoming endangered in the foreseeable future. Regarding the appellant's point that there may be remnant populations in 45 years, the Fish and Wildlife Service acknowledged that there may be remnant populations, that the populations in the convergent and archipelago areas are anticipated to be declining within 45 years, and the fact that there may be some remnant populations is not a basis for undercutting the listing determination here. It had the service found that all populations would be extinct in 45 years, that would have been a basis perhaps for listing it as endangered rather than threatened.
Are they seriously challenging, the other side seriously challenging all of your data and propositions on the climate changes for the next 40 to 50 years is largely set? I don't think
they
so.
They have not.
Yeah, and that's really the foundation of the government's position here, right?
It's two things. It's the reliability of the data on climate change and its effect on sea ice loss and the polar bear's dependence on sea ice and its the effect of loss of sea ice on their ability to survive and reproduce, right? And they haven't challenged either of those things. Basically, as we read their argument, while they cabin it as a failure to explain a link between the data and the conclusion, they seem to really be asking for a greater degree of certainty. But as the Endangered Species Act is clear, and this court has held in other cases, the agency needs to make a determination based on the best available science as it did here. They've identified no science that the agency should have considered and didn't. And as you indicated earlier, they overemphasized the agency's reliance on the two models. The agency did rely on the two models, but it indicated problems with the models or limitations on them, and it had proposed listing prior to having done the models.
Can I ask you about the government's position with respect to the requirement to submit to the state agency a written justification? I guess my first question is, there is the most elliptical sentence suggesting that maybe we don't have jurisdiction for some reason. What's the argument about that?
Yeah, the written justification is a little bit of an anomaly in at least in the administrative law that we could find. Our argument is that they haven't identified any injury specifically relating to the written justification. Haven't attacked the sufficiency of the comments, the response to comments in the listing rule. And that's where, but they suggest that in a written justification, the agency needs to separately address all of its comments, whereas actually the place where the agency needs to respond to the comments is in the listing rule. So had we provided a more thorough written justification, we don't see, given that they accept the viability of the agency's response to their comments.
That sounds like a substantive response, that it's not arbitrary and capricious because we gave an answer to everything and we basically repeated it, but with some only in 45 pages instead of 2,000. But that sounds like a substantive response. It's not what we've done is not arbitrary and capricious. That doesn't sound like it's a reason for us to say we didn't have jurisdiction to look at it any more than in the rulemaking when you give an explanation. You can say that we don't have jurisdiction to look at that because you're not aggrieved by the explanation, you're aggrieved by the rule. This sounds more to me like the, if you're looking for an analogy, the Regulatory Flexibility Act, where we've held that the procedural requirements are not reviewable because the statute says they're not, but what the agency says is, like anything else it says at the time it issues a rule, reviewable for whether it's arbitrary and capricious. In this case, your answer is it's not arbitrary and capricious because we gave reasonable answers and they're not really objecting to them.
Right.
You're not making an argument that this is not final agency action or something like that, are you? That the written explanation sent to Alaska is not final agency action. That's not your argument.
No, that's not our argument.
I mean, it smells like a mini standing argument, but it doesn't seem to work.
Well, that's for you to decide, for us to argue.
Very diplomatic.
It's certainly not something the agency wants to bust to pick over. So, in any event, the written justification here was adequate, and we disagree with the appellants about what the remedy would be for an inadequate written justification. Judge Garland, the procedural reference that you made, I don't know if that's a pre-final agency action procedural requirement or a post one. That's what's a little bit perplexing about this, is because clearly the listing rule is reviewable and it's final when it's issued. And we just, it's almost akin to challenges to the agency's failure to publish something in the Federal Register. I mean, we acknowledge that the written justification requires more than actual notice, which is what the earlier provisions require for a proposed rule. But it's just a sort of strange entity.
I don't want to bust a pick over this either. But you think that a rule wouldn't be invalid if it's not published in the Federal Register?
Well,
if the agency has a secret rule that they don't publish in the Federal Register, wouldn't we say that's not good enough?
The APA says that, you can't apply it to that person if they don't have notice of it. Right.
Right.
Right. But okay, usually the remedy for that is to require publication in the Federal Register.
Yes, and if there were a problem here, the remedy might be to require a written justification. But as you point out, you've already given one. So.
Exactly. Yeah.
Could I ask you about this idea of the best available science? The petitioners here took issue both with the carrying capacity model and with this Bayesian network model, and it appears that the service agrees with them about the flaws of those models, correct?
I'm sorry, I didn't.
In other words, they have raised some issues about the CM model and this BM model.
Right.
And it seems like the service is agreeing with them because the service says, well, we didn't really rely on those models. We recognize that they're flawed.
Well, I wouldn't go that far as far as the agency's position. It doesn't say we don't rely on them. The carrying capacity model basically was sort of a floor. It's like, there's this much ice. We're not going to look at, whether this ice is viable habitat for polar bears. We're just looking at the amount of ice, and then if you extrapolate that, so it's a floor. There, and the agency recognized that. Okay, And then as to the Bayesian model, the agency said, you know, this is a first run model, and we are going to rely, we are going to look at its indications of trends, but we're not going to rely on the specific probabilities. This model merely supports the vast other information on which the agency relied in making its proposed rule, the other USGS studies done after it issued the proposed rule, and basically all the data that are uncontroverted about the trend in sea ice declines and its impact on polar bear species. I hope that's responsive. In sum, enlisting the polar bear, the service analyzed decades of research on polar bears and extensive research on past, present, and projected sea ice loss. Scientists who reviewed the service's findings agree that the species is likely to become in danger of extinction throughout its range in the foreseeable future, and the listing should be upheld.
Okay, thank you. Does Mr. Feldman have any time? Okay, we just let the government go over by 2 minutes, so I'll give you government's 2 minutes here.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just 3 points to come back to. First, the federal government and the court were questioning about what is really the gravamen of the appellant's claims here, and that is that the service improperly made the determination based on just a trend of habitat loss without identifying where that trend was going in terms of the point at which the species might become endangered that would support a threatened determination. And I believe that's consistent with the Ninth Circuit decision in Defenders that we cite in its brief, where the Ninth Circuit there said a species with an exceptionally large historical range may continue to enjoy healthy population levels despite the loss of a substantial amount of sustainable habitat. And that is the point here. The service needed to make that case-by-case determination of what was going to happen here, but relied instead just on a trend of declining habitat without tying that to the population effects.
Can I just ask you, I'm sorry to get back on this U.S. Geological Service point that Judge Edwards asked you about. You started by saying that the Geological Service thought that the model had problems. But now I've looked at the page of the where they say that, and their problem with the model is that it's too conservative. Things are actually going to get worse. So how does that support your proposition here? If the model is, if anything, too conservative, and that the speed is even greater than the government is accepting, that's their floor, how does that help you? The model is flawed in the direction against you.
Well, I'm not sure, Your Honor, the report said that the model's flawed in the direction against us so much as that it may have provided a conservative estimate. But our argument...
Yes, but a conservative estimate meant that it could be worse, not that it could be better.
Right, but our argument was perhaps one step back in the reasoning process, saying even before that, the Geological Survey acknowledged that that carrying capacity model didn't really fit for what the service was trying to work with it for, to provide outward forecasts of population projections. And the USGS didn't say it didn't fit because it was overly conservative. It said it didn't fit because the assumptions about the relationship of habitat to population density were almost certainly invalid.
The USGS at 438 says, to be clear, we do not challenge the scientific support for the draft final rule. Close quote. Isn't it? So how can we use that as a reason to challenge the support for the scientific support for the rule?
I believe Your Honor is reading from the USGS's comments on the draft final rule.
Yes, exactly.
And on this almost certainly invalid assumption point, we were pointing to the USGS report on the population forecasting, which came after the draft final rule.
Fair point. Okay, thank you.
Just the other 2 points really quickly, that we're not raising a best science claim. This is an APA-based claim. And that the essence of the modeling claim here is that the service identified the limits and the drawbacks on the models, but we're saying that's not enough just to state those. What the service did here, for instance, was it said you can't use these models for these purposes, like outward population forecasts. It said you can't even use the Bayesian model to support an endangered determination, but then it went ahead and used the models for those purposes. That's the inconsistency. It used them to support population forecasts, and it used it to support a listing decision, a threatened determination under the Act, when it said they weren't reliable enough to support an endangered determination, another listing determination under the Act. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. We'll take the case under submission. Thank you.